Would you like to tell me, first of all, about your early years? I mean, what you did before you met Annie?
Well, it was very mixed. I was one of the last of a family of four, the youngest of a family of four. And I started as choir boy and choir boy. Then after I left school at 14, I had various kinds of jobs, and eventually going into a firm with a friend of my brother's, I started cabinet making, and then into coppersmithing and brass finishing. It was a very comprehensive firm, as they all were in those days, working 12 hours a day, travelling from one side of London to the other. But one had very little time. But as I progressed, I went to evening classes on top of a 12-hour day, and gained my certificates in 1911. And I carried on then got into the motor industry.
What did you do in your evening classes?
I took sheet metal work.
I see, so it was for your job, really?
Yes, I was in the coppersmithing department at that time, and I was interested in coppersmithing and in all hand work. So I took that and got and gained my certificates, which was the only type of certificate available to what I would call tradesmen in those days. There were no higher national certificates as such, but that was accepted as a status, and I felt quite pleased. Then the first, and then I went into, I got tired of the motor industry, and I went into the Variety Theatre for a while. There was always being interested in singing, there was an advertisement for the Palladium Minstrels. I went for an audition and walked through, and we toured about the country for over the Christmas period for quite a long time. And then the war came along, and having been in the cadets from the time of 1904.
What sort of cadets?
Well, the London Church Tides Brigade, we were attached in those days, or affiliated, that's a better word, to the Guards, which we thought was a really wonderful. And I became a sergeant in the cadets, and then war broke out, and I volunteered straight away. Went into the 60th Rifles, which was called the King's Royal Rifles, and within a week I got my first stripe, within two weeks a second stripe, and within a month I got a third stripe. And then I moved back with the battalion, and then eventually I was transferred to the Flying Corps because they were screaming for craftsmen, and I went into the Air Force, or Flying Corps it was then, and stayed with them until I got discharged, or at least not transferred off the active list, and put on to munitions, which was eventually being transferred to the Royal Naval Torpedo Factory in Greenock. And stayed there until the end of the war. And it was during the latter part of that, the middle 1980s,
yes,
that we used to have one weekend off a month, if we were lucky. And it was during one of those weekends, and one of the fellows in the digs that I was staying with, a brilliant pianist, Freddie Brocklebank, he suggested, let's go for a weekend to the Isle of Arran. I'd never heard of that place, or heard of it, didn't know where it was, and it was a very fine run down to the Isle of Arran on wonderful ships they were then in those days, the clippers. And it was raining hard, pouring with rain that Saturday. We used to set off America for 8:30 and get there about 3:00. So we went into the smoking room, and Freddie saw piano, he had to sit down and play, and automatically I started singing. We carried on quietly, on our own, nobody else in the hotel. And the hotel was run by we didn't know at that time, a Mistress Macmillan, who was a relation of the Macmillan family, because that end of the Isle of Arran was all Macmillan country. And we sang for a long time, and dinner came along, we went in and had a meal. At the end of the meal, Mrs. Macmillan came in through an archway somewhat similar to that into the dining room, and she wondered if the two gentlemen would kindly continue or entertain the guests. As it was still raining so hard, Freddie looked at me. Oh, you're all right, but I only got a limited amount of music with me, and he knew the majority of the stuff I sang, and we carried on for an hour and a half. And then we all rain stopped, and we all wandered down the up the valley, and then we had another concert in the before we left on the Monday, well, Tuesday morning. Three or four, and it was then that I met Annie, Jessie, Grace, Peggy Macmillan, Flora didn't come, I think Flora drummed with them, I'm not quite sure. And we used to wander about all over the place during those weekends, and then...
What were they doing there, actually?
Well, they were resting, because this was one of their hideouts during the Cat and Mouse. They used to rest there, but they were resting at this stage, getting over the all that they'd suffered, because Annie suffered considerably from the forcible feeding. Oh, you better switch this thing off, or else I don't get annoyed. we had many. Then after that, I was invited back again. Well, a fortnight, three weeks after the first meeting, Freddie and I were invited back to the island as Mrs. Macmillan's guests, because the church, or church and school combined, wanted some funds, and they intended to run a concert. So we went along the first weekend we had, and we were taken into the hall. We had to run round and get all the old fish boxes we could, and we built a stage, and we dragged the piano down from one end of the village to the other, and between us, I think we gave a two-hour concert. And again, Annie and all the group were there. And then, after that, they left the island, and Peggy kept in touch with me.
That's Peggy...
Peggy Macmillan.
Oh, yes. She was the woman running the
place. She was the daughter of the Mrs. Macmillan that was running the hotel.
Oh, I see, yes. Was she a suffragette?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, she was.
I see.
She was quite young, so she didn't... She only took a... was on the fringe of the movement, breaking windows, this, and going to the tea speeches and making speeches and attending all the meetings.
Was her mother also suffragette?
Well, and yes, she agreed, but of course she was running the hotel,
yes.
So that she had every sympathy with them,
yes,
and they were always invited to the hotel whenever they wanted to rest or run away to the hideout on certain occasions.
Anyway, they went away, sorry.
They went away, and then the war finished and I was discharged, went back to London. Peggy had my address, and right out of the blue, I got a telegram that Miss Kenny, would I go to Tower Cressy, which was just off Notting Hill, off Holland Park, at Notting Hill Gate. Miss Kenny would like to meet me. So off I went to, I was living in Chamberwood Road in London then, and off I went, the best big tucker on kind of business, and met Annie in a wonderful, wonderful house, almost a dream castle, in which two of her sisters, this is where the Kenny tradition, it's extraordinary, two of her sisters, Kitty and Jenny, had both been trained by Madame Montessori in her method of teaching, and they came out with first class honours almost. They ran, took this house, Tower Cressy, in which they were educated children from unmarried mothers. And it was amazing to see what they were doing with those children. It was just out of this world. Their education was first class. The whole atmosphere that was built up around them with this Montessori background principles, it was amazing. Well, then I met Annie and I met several times, and I was divorced in an open house. We used to go wandering around London, and then we had a favourite little meeting restaurant in the bottom of Church Street, Kensington, where we went many times. I must be quite honest, I was earning less than £2 a week in those days, so that money was pretty tight, but anyway. We used to go to this little restaurant, and then we'd often go for bus rides, and the horse buses they were in many cases in those days. And Annie would insist on sitting on the top in the front seats. And we went for miles all over, Richmond Park, all over the place. And then Annie went off to Lugano. She was feeling tired. Well, something I've been always. Kitty and Jenny were getting up the school because they had a very good offer to open up a similar school in America, just outside New York, which they did. And they took girls on to university stage. So Annie went off to Lugano. I think Grace went with her, I'm not quite sure. But we corresponded quite a lot. And then she came back again and we met again. And then we decided to get married on the top of, a bus. One of Annie's favourite bus journeys. And we decided to get married. Annie, I wouldn't say tempestuous, that's the wrong word, wanted to get everything done quickly once it was established. Let's get it done. Couldn't wait for 3 weeks and bands to be out. Let's get a special license. So off Grace and I were chased to the Bishop of London. And we had to go to Doctor's Commons behind St Paul's Cathedral. And I thought, I just made a note of it there. The impression that I got, was everything brushed aside when Grace came in with her personality. She oozed it in those days, with a long flowing cape on. And I felt I was walking into the whole world of Dickens in those Doctor's Commons offices with the high desks and high stools, and we were treated most courteously, taken into a side room, and they discovered and found out what we wanted, and we're told what we could not do, what we'd have to get, and what must be done. First of all, I must have suitable references. Grace puts me in a taxi. Go on, off you go. Chase off. Go by the vicar of the... I've never met him. Go and find out. Saw him. He said, well, sorry, first time I've ever met you. So I went and saw one of the two employers that I was working with at that time. Oh, sure. So I wrote out. Chased off back to Doctor's Commons with this thing. They read it very carefully. Had a little conference on it. Oh yes, got you. So eventually we came away with the appropriate document, and the enormous great thing, and I saw the man cut a quill pen and inscribe the document, and I still got it then. And then we were married, and decided we'd go back to La Franja for a honeymoon. We stayed there for 2 months. And then came back. By this time, Grace had gone off to London to find a house.
For you both, you mean?
For us both.
Yes.
She found one in Acacia Road, St John's Wood. We stayed there for quite a while, and it was from there that Annie was taken into a nursing home at Warrington Crescent. And Warwick was born. That was on the 4th of February. That was 21. And then I went off to Italy. Annie was most keen that, again through strings he had, that I should go off to Italy. And Kitty and Jenny at this stage had among her pupils Caruso's daughter, his second wife. And this opened doors. Well, Caruso and his wife had gone then. Unfortunately, Caruso died. August 21. But I was sent off, met Mrs. Caruso, and had I been able to speak German, I think I should have become a secretary. She offered me the post because she'd got thousands of letters, the whole hotel. I stayed there for a while and was sent over to Sorrento to meet. It was in Calais, I think it was. And they wanted, he was quite willing to take me under his wing, but it meant travelling around because he got a lot of students. And
you were thinking of singing as a career at that time? Yes.
Because I had been singing, it was this, I suppose, that was instrumental. The singing at those concerts in the hotel that brought Annie and I together. Of course, you should say extraordinary things about my voice, but he was quite prepared, but it meant he had this group of American students or young people that were, must have been fabulously wealthy, but they were travelling about all over Italy, and he was going with them, and the fees were absolutely exorbitant, and the cost of living, but the moving around, it was just impossible. So I came back, but still kept in touch with them. And then we went and stayed with them. They gave the house up at Annie, gave the house up at Acacia Road. And we stayed with one of my sisters for a short while, and then we came down to Letchworth.
Why did you come to Letchworth?
Well, again, through Annie's friends and the. She met so many people in the movement. Among them was a group of the Theosophists that were all thinking that their thought waves were along the same lines, at that higher level, if I might put it that way. And among them were many Theosophists who were interested and were running the original St. Christopher's School here. And they thought there were many opportunities. Letchworth was up and coming then. They thought there were many opportunities, and suggested we came down, which we did. And in many ways, I've never looked back on it. But I came along and got a job.
You all this time you've been keeping up your craftsman.
Oh yes, work, yes, yes, yes,
yes, yes. So you were still earning £2 a week.
The only job that's available at that particular moment was plumber's mate. I took a job as a plumber's mate, which was around about £2 a week. And we lived on it quite well.
Was Annie earning all this time?
No, Annie's not earning at all. Annie was extraordinary. We came down, Warwick was only, maybe about one year old, I think, then.
Why do you call him Warwick, actually?
hope this should not be recorded, by the way. Where do we get to now?
Well, you've got to, Warwick's born, and you've come back from
Italy. We came to Letchworth, and I carried on quite a long time with the local plumber's firm, and then they asked me to run a theatre, which was in Letchworth for a while, which I did for quite a long time.
The Palace Theatre, is that?
No, it was it's where a bowling green is. That was Eastie, which is all the Palace, that was the cinema.
Yes.
But the whole thing had been pulled down now, and I ran that for quite a long time. And then after a while, that dried up. And I went and worked with my brother in London, and because he's beginning to grow up. And it was at this stage that Annie's wonderful personality, I wouldn't say developed because it was there, but it was used to influence Warwick, because she was his first and last thought. And we agreed that after Annie completed the last chapters of her book, that the whole of her attention and activities would be devoted to Warwick, to bringing up Warwick, because I was flitting about between London and Letchworth. And she did, every minute of the day and night was devoted to him. And using the wonderful training she had from the Kenny family and put it into Warwick.
You mean the Montessori?
In the Kenny family, when they were poor, we're diverting again, they'll keep branching away.
Don't worry, it doesn't matter.
And his family, as I said, were an outstanding family. They were brought up on the classics. Her father was a mill worker, her mother was a an Irish person, and one must have been, I never met them, but from all I heard, they must have been wonderful. Now, they were all encouraged and brought up on the classics round the fireside, and then they would walk for miles over the hills and discuss everything, every book, every subject that was written. Well, all that became a tremendous help to them, because when I look at the progress that that family, the marks they've made in life, Roland, I think Roland was the oldest brother, he came to London, as I understand it, without a penny in his pocket, slept on the embankment, and eventually became a councillor in the Foreign Office. Starting from nothing, Jessie became the first woman in the world to gain a seagoing wireless telegraphy operator's licence. But the trade unions wouldn't accept her. And Kitty and Jenny reached the peak of the profession, in the teaching profession, of running that Montessori school, so that the... And then there was Annie getting into the suffrage movement, and as soon as she walked in, apparently, for all I've heard, and for Grace and many other... Well, Grace wasn't in it then. What I heard from many of them, but she was accepted straight away. Her approach to the problem. She was accepted straight away. It was like a magnet drawn a piece of mild steel, and she was accepted straight away. So that the traditions of the Kenny family shone out like a beacon.
So it wasn't a coincidence that Warwick was called Warwick, because she'd read a lot of Shakespeare, I suppose, and, well, you both did, presumably.
I didn't read a lot, but Annie would read and read and read to him, and the whole of her life was devoted to him and bringing him up, and so that, I was away in London quite often, until the job cropped up in the Government Training Centre that was just beginning to start.
What was the Government Training Centre?
Those were run by the Ministry of Labour in those days. This, I'm speaking now of 1929, because after that period.
For unemployed people?
These were for miners, unemployed from the depressed areas.
Yes, I see.
We're perhaps diversing a bit, but the basic object of that in those days was to draw that labour potential from the depressed areas, which of course were mining areas, from South Wales and the North East, draw them away, train, put... Those people arrived 200, 250 a week, and with nothing but their spare shirt button.
So you were managing
I was an instructor at that stage, and they had arrived. Now, those fellows had never seen their fathers do a day's work, and we had them for training. And again, this shouldn't be put on that thing.
That's for sure.
It consisted of people right across the industrial world, from every form of engineering, building. That, and it was basically a 6 months training, and eventually it was extended to all kinds of other watch and clock repairing, dressmaking, draftsmanship. That, and then when the munitions drive came on, they were accepted. Now, all this time, or by this time, then Warwick had gone to school, and Annie was living quite... Jessie was came to stay with us. She, by this time, was a first-class stewardess on the Orient Line.
Where did Warwick go to school?
Went to... it was Little Brick Hill, just outside Bedford, run by the Parents National Education Union. Oh, forget the headmaster's name.
What was the idea of the school? It was a boarding school.
A boarding school, yes.
And what were their ideas about education then?
Well, it was a standard education, but run rather differently from the rigid public school lines. But I don't know. To be quite honest, I don't know of any of the outstanding differences. No. But it was one might call the standard curriculum. But there was an enormous amount of personal instruction given to them, because Warwick at that stage, which my family used to get very annoyed about, he could hardly he couldn't write. I know at that stage, and he was very backward in one way in his speech. And we went and saw the doctor, our local doctor of Belgium, So we were rather concerned about it. And he was a fine family doctor. He said,
how old was Sir Warwick then?
Sir Warwick, this stage, he was about 6, 7. Five, he couldn't write. His speech was not slow, and we didn't worry. This Belgian doctor said, no, don't worry what's happening now. You wait till he's 21 and see what happens. Mm. Many times I thought of that. And then from the training he received at that school, this all developed. Mm. He finished his schooling, he went to Aristotle, and during this period, every time he came home from school, and he would take him all around all the various churches and denominations, from theosophists to socialists to spiritualists to Roman Catholics to the Free Church and the Church of England, and would discuss these things with him. And eventually, finished school, he joined St. Paul's Church, the other side of the church, and there was an exceedingly fine vicar, E.C. Killick, who was a cricketer, played cricket for England, a fine, fine man, and he had a wonderful curate. And he took an strong liking to Warwick, so much so that he approached Annie many times, and he said he thought Warwick was a type to go into the church, mm. and he would help him all he possibly could. But you know, Warwick went to a big engineering firm, Crinodlay as we call it here, and went into the drawing office, and he did very well. The war came along, and he eventually, I was sent off to a training centre. I became almost a troubleshooter, and sent off to open up a centre at Stafford. And while I was there, I got a letter to say that he'd joined the Navy in the Fleet Air Arm, and he did very well. He eventually got his commission, and during the event the squadron went out based on Australia, and during that period he got his DSC.
In engineering?
No, as a DSC, Distinguished Service. Some activity.
I keep on thinking academic terms.
some activity which we never knew happened. He was the senior, by this time he was a senior observer on the Victorious. And it was some activity on board that he gained this decoration.
This was in the Second World War?
Yes.
Yes.
So then all this was character building, and plus the being thrown into the Navy, where he was given this responsibility from the moment he got his commission, and all bore him very, very good stead, that he could meet anybody and discuss anything with them and be at home. And I was always down on the practical, with the feet on the ground on the practical level. But this again was all Annie's training bearing fruit. I can't speak too highly of how Annie transferred these extraordinary this extraordinary character.
And she encouraged him to argue and think and reason.
Yes,
and
yes.
Things like that. Yeah.
So that he can go and he'll meet anybody now, and if even from. When he came back after the war, he went back to Krim, and he had to pick up the threads again and started right from the bottom on the bench, on the floor, shop floor, and eventually worked his way up and came in charge of the crane development, the mobile crane development scheme.
Then what's the firm called?
The Crinodlay. We speak of them as Crinodlay. They're now known as...
How do you spell it? I'm not...
I'm digressing. It was a Belgian firm.
Oh,
K-R-Y-N... and L-A-H-Y, a firm who were brought to Letchworth during the First War when Liège was smashed up.
Mm.
They were a steel founding firm, founders. They were brought to Letchworth and started up with a whole batch of Belgians.
Yes.
And there was a colony of houses built over that side.
I see.
And,
So he's still working for them, is he now?
No, he's always had one or two moves. Before he left there, he became in charge of the mobile crane section to the directors, and he was put in charge of the all the orders and supplies to the various services departments, the Navy, or the Air Force and the Army, and he was doing an enormous amount of research work with them. So then period, he was meeting admirals and generals and good Tom, Dick and Harry, and quite at home, again through this bearing that training that Annie had given him, and it all came to his help. Well, then he left them and went with another corporation, the Steel Corporation, as a director. And now he's a big Jew man, bought up that firm, and things didn't work out as they planned. Mm. So he went with a splinter group that had broken away, and he's now, he wears two hats, he tells me. I hope I'm not digressing too much.
No, I'm kidding you too.
He's now director of one branch of the firm and chief plant engineer or plant developments.
So he's director of Richards and Wallington Limited in London.
Yes.
And he's chief developments engineer of Richards and Wallington as well.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Richards and Wallington Overseas Limited is a director, and he's chief developments engineer of Richards and Wallington Industries Limited.
Yes. Now he's just recently returned from a worldwide tour, a business trip covering America, Canada, West Indies, Australia.
Do you think if I asked him, do you think he'd talk about his mother?
He'd be delighted.
Would he?
And both he and his wife.
Oh, that would be marvellous. Because you see, I live in London, and at least I've got a flat in London.
Now he's living in Birmingham.
In Birmingham.
Burnham.
Oh, I know
that. Slough.
Yes. So Warwick did very well.
He did. Then they got married. Annie carried on in very, very quietly, still keeping in touch with many, many of her friends. Lord Pethick Lawrence, whose sister was an outstanding character, she built, after travelling all over the world for years, built a house here in Letchworth, which all buildings, an extraordinary place, known as the Cloisters, which used to be open every weekend. And however much was collected, Miss Lawrence, she would put in the same amount into the collection box.
And she must have been very
And wealthy. She'd help no end of people in a very, very quiet manner in Letchworth. So that...
Did Annie see very much of her wife?
No. Annie never met Miss Lawrence, as we always speak of her, but she was outstanding. But then Lord and Lady... She eventually went into a nursing home, and Lord Pethick Lawrence... used to come down once a month to see his sister, who was by this time in a nursing home, and always came to call on us, came in to see Annie at One Campus Road.
Mm-hmm.
Each time he came down,
that's very nice of him.
He would always say, "Oh, he was a charming man."
Mm-hmm.
Here he was a lord, but to me, obviously, he was quite a labourer kind of, not just an ordinary, but it didn't make any difference to him at all. Mm-hmm. Which is what I found with so many of what I call the genuinely educated person.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter who they meet.
Mm.
They don't use their rank or their position. No. This is the thing that always astounds me with them.
Mm.
But Annie was leading a quite domestic life. But during this period, she became exceedingly interested in the Rosicrucian movement.
You mentioned that on your piece of paper.
Mm. And she gained the highest honours in that, and she was deeply involved in the, because this again gave her the opportunity of developing or using this wonderful thought power, I think I could express it as, of using it and developing, and not to her own benefit, but to other people's benefit, quietly. Not blowing any trumpets about it.
Do they have a church? I'm afraid I don't know
about it. No, it's one of these quiet American type of, grew up in America. No, they don't have any church as such.
Yes.
It's a group that they keep in touch with each other.
So there were quite a lot of them in Letchworth, were there?
No, I don't know. I don't know anyone else. There were a lot of theosophists in Letchworth. And Annie was interested in theosophy.
Was she?
For quite a long time, but I don't know if it's in Annie's book, but it comes up in the, oh, it doesn't come up in there, in that shoulder-to-shoulder thing. It was Mrs. Pankhurst, of one of the early days of the movement. I think it's mentioned in the shoulder-to-shoulder script, that Mrs. Pankhurst said, "Now, Annie, you've got to decide on which you are going to concentrate on, theosophy or the movement. You can't serve the two masters."
So she'd been
so Annie broke away from the theosophy, but she still had the basic principles in mind the whole time, because this was in line with the intelligent approach to the whole of the Kenny family, to the what one might call the spiritual thought, I think, if that's the right word.
So when she, when the suffragette movement came to an end, she became more interested in theosophy.
Yes, she had more time to develop this, and then of course Warwick came along, but she still kept in touch. And but when she became interested in the Rosicrucian world, then of course Warwick was, what one might say, off her hands in a way, that she was able to do many, but she spent many hours writing and studying.
So what did she do? She read books about it, did she?
Oh, she read books, and yes, and there was a lot of correspondence, travel between America and Letchworth, and they had quite a number of books, I think, they used to, books particular to them, some of their people, I suppose, had written.
Did she speak to meetings and things like that?
No, there was no meetings, as I know, as such. There were meetings in London, but I think she did go to attend one or two in London, but there were no meetings that I know of ever held in Letchworth. But no, she kept herself to in the domestic circle with this high line of thought in the background the whole time.
Were you also a Rosicrucian?
No. I'm quite honest. I was, I wouldn't say so busy.
It wasn't your line.
Not in my line. Although I was brought up in the church. I wouldn't say I broke away from it, but I drifted away. That's the right word. And I became very interested in the Letchworth cricket world, because this was all part and parcel of the my 30 years of training, where we had to, those early boys who came in the early stages, we were working, a 7.5-8 hour day, and during the weekends these boys were in digs. The landladies were only paid 17 shillings a week for one meal, and weekend meals, we fed them at the centre. So we had to do something for these boys, and we built up, I was instrumental in building up a very, very strong sports club and welfare club. So I became deeply involved with that. Probably as soon as I came home, we finished about 5:30, I rushed home, come home and just have a meal, and fly off back.
So you both had busy lives of your own.
Cricket matches and rugby and dances and
Was she interested in all that sort of thing?
Yes, but at this stage, Annie was, I wouldn't say she was not an invalid in any way, but it was such an active type of life that she knew what I was doing, quite happy with it. She didn't involve herself in any of the Letchworth activities, as one might call it, other than a group of friends and neighbours, who thought the world would worship every photograph
she
wore.
What sort of friends did she have, actually?
In Letchworth, just ordinary housewives. And I think that would sum it up, really.
They admired her because of her background.
And yet they knew, didn't know the first thing about her. But this was it was like a beam of light shining out that as soon as she approached anybody, within a half an hour they'd be kind of worshipping her, and I've been amazed at the people I've met that have spoken of her along these lines. That it was an extraordinary personality. Again, all based on that initial training and atmosphere of the Kenny family.
So how did she spend her time? I mean, reading, when she was bringing up Warwick, in the earlier years?
In between reading, and studying
on the Rosicrucian theosophy.
Well, theosophy and that on that in that world, in the elevated world, as I often like to refer to it. But I became interested in the activities of Letchworth and the cricket club. I never missed umpire. I played for a little while, and then I promoted to umpire, and I never missed a match for about 10 or 11 years. And they made me a life member, which I still am one of. There's only about four of us left, I think. Yeah. So that, and on Saturday afternoons I was away, Sundays I was nearly always away. And so Annie devoted the whole of her life during that period. And then Jessie, her sister-in-law, used to come and stay with us in between her trips back and forwards to Australia. That all helped Warwick and kept Annie busy.
How big was your house, actually?
Oh, it was a council house. It was a three-bedroom house with a living room and parlour, as it was called on then, the lounge or parlour. A corner house, quite a nice garden in the front. I was not interested in garden because I was flitting about like a bird. And it was not until the later years that I had quite a nice garden there. But,
so it was a smallish house and quite easy to manage.
Oh yes, quite, yes. Oh yes, quite a big three bedroom, quite a big house in a way that we managed it. Annie had a woman came in, her quite a character. She used to come in on weekends and do the heavier work or whatever. Even in there before that, Annie coped with all the housework on top of all this other side, which was so miles apart from this elevated line of thought.
What was she like in the house, actually?
Very good.
She was good at cooking, was she?
Oh yes, cook anything. Very, very good indeed. A real housewife and a real mother. That nothing was too small or too great.
What sort of things did she like cooking? I mean, was it good plain English cooking?
Good plain English, yes, good food. Oh, we used to have some fun with the cooking. Christmas time, we used to several Christmases when Warwick went to school, and when he came to school, we'd have quite a number of friends in, and Anne would enter. She'd be the life and soul of the party.
What did she do? Did she sing? Or?
No, just keep the conversation and keep the game she would, and have sing songs going, kind of thing, round the fireside. Real home life, developing a real home life, and fun, overflowing with fun.
Because Grace Rose, he said she never really recovered from her hunger strikes. She never really completely got better.
At the background, this was the trouble. It was there all the time, but she was so, her willpower was so wonderful, so tremendous, that she could put this aside.
But she was ill quite a lot.
She wouldn't acknowledge, she wouldn't acknowledge it.
Mm.
And it didn't show, this was it, until the latter part of her life, and when eventually she died of diabetes, which was a shock the doctor thought that could have been developed from that force of the hunger striking, and because she went, what those people went through, when I heard this from many of them, it was agony.
She died in 1953.
53 years.
Yes.
And missed a hospital.
Yes, yes. Did she have a long illness beforehand, or was it?
No, it was a long
decline.
Steady decline. Unfortunately, by this time I'd got out into the higher grades of the civil service, or the ministerial training department. The Ministry of Labour was a Cinderella of the department. We had no official representation as such in those days, but. We used to get, in the higher grades, we used to get bounced about. I was chief instructor in those stages, bounced about to different centres, or I became known as a troubleshooter. Opening centres up and closing centres down. During the war, it was quite a hectic life, so I was pushed about, and during this period, one occasion, then the last occasion, 51, I was sent to a rehabilitation, pretty large rehabilitation unit at Egham, which was on the borders of Windsor Great Park. And it was during that period then that I think diabetes had been diagnosed and That was a gradual
decline. Because they weren't as good at curing it anyway in those days.
Given insulin, of course, and they weren't able to isolate it or control it. Well, control it, I suppose that's the word.
Mm.
And then when she died, 53, for 3 weeks I was like a lost sheep. I never went back to the centre for, or never went near it for 3 weeks. And one of our managers from headquarters came down, and he was a fine man. And he came out to see me. He said, "Now," I said, "I'm not going to say what's your trouble, Jim, because I know." He said, "Well, look, come back. Just come back for a couple of hours." He said, "We want you." And he said, "I'll help you. Don't worry about signing books or anything. Just come back." And I did. And I got over the terrific shock.
Work's the best painkiller, isn't it?
Yes.
Really?
And I became then deeply involved, because at that time we had, 1,500 trainees in the centre, and all the problems...
All was still at Letchworth.
Yes.
Yes.
And then eventually I retired in 58.
Mm. You retired at 65, did you?
Unfortunately, being in the higher grade, which is quite right, I was deputy manager then. There was only one more step further on.
Mm.
Deputy manager, and when you retire, prior to retiring, there's a whole lot of formalities to go through, and you were given the opportunity of continuing, or making an application to continue, which I did. And it was pointed out then that one of the very nice letter I got, host of them, that I really regret they were unable to find a post for me in which to continue, because there were so many, there was only one head, and there were so many coming up the ladder that it was wrong to keep this one there and prevent them coming up.
Yes.
So I retired at 58. In the lower grades, in the instructor grade, yes, there been many people were kept on 2 and 3 years, especially in the blind training section.
Mm.
We were the first government training centre in the world, in this country, in the world, you might say, in the world, to start training blind, 100% blind people for open industry.
Mm.
Open industry.
So there are some in Cowley in Oxford, of course, now.
Yes,
blind people.
But it all started. It's in Dunstan's. Mm. They were training for specialised. They were, the St Dunstan's people were able to choose, very selective, in choosing their employers who would cooperate in so far as to put in special machines. But when it came to the Ministry of Labour, came round to the Ministry of Labour, we had one of the RNIB people came down and gave us a talk before the arrangement headquarters. It had nothing to do with the initial stages. And he gave us a talk and stressed that their placing department in the RNIB had the responsibility of placing these people in an industry. And they had already run up against a snag where many employers said, "Oh, I can't take a blind man because he'll want a special machine, he'll want special safety precautions. I can't afford it." Another thing, we might modify a machine to suit the blind man. The foreman may not like him in a fortnight, or he may not like the foreman and he's off out, and there's a special purpose machine, as far as we're concerned, destroyed. So that the training has got to be on perfectly normal, straightforward, practical machines, or
make them completely normal. So
completely
speak,
normal
workers.
People, make them completely independent.
Did Annie, was it any interested in this side of things?
No, she was into, she came down to the centre once or twice, no. But
She was in the labour movement, wasn't she,
early
on?
Yes.
Did she stay in the labour
movement? She was there, no. Sympathetically, yes, she was, but she was the first woman president in the, she became first woman chairman in the labour woman, in the labour movement. In Oldham, which was in the middle.
I really wondered, when you came to Letchworth, I mean, a lot of Labour people here.
The original people were Ebenezer Howard, Friar Tuck, as we called him, Firmerston. They were all strong Labour people.
But you say she was asked to stand or help in a Liberal election?
Yes.
Did she became a Liberal, did she?
No, wish it. They'd asked her to, because of her... a knowledge of politics or application, I suppose, that I asked her to speak for her. But,
I see.
Which she did. She was so open-minded.
Yes.
That I had been a Conservative.
Did she vote Labour usually, or Liberal, you think, or what?
I think her tendency to be for Labour, I think.
Although she never turned against the Labour
Party? Oh, no, no, I don't know. No, no. Yeah. Oh, no, she had a... Because Keir Hardie had a deep impression on her. Lansbury. They had a deep impression on her. At one stage, Keir Hardie almost wanted to adopt her as a daughter.
She was right in the centre of
Labour movement at one time. Yes, in those early days, and before she got into the movement.
But she wasn't active in local Labour Party activities.
No, as such.
Did she ever think of having a job?
No.
She never thought of having a career?
No, once we were married, she dropped, if I think that's the right word, all her activities in the political world, and devoted the whole of her energies and efforts on Warwick, and myself.
So when Warwick left home, she had nothing to do much, I suppose. And so she took up Rosicrucian
while he was at school, this started developing, while she was at school, because she had so much time on her hands that... I could go on talking, really.
You say she was a good cook. Was she house proud? Was she?
Well, no. I wouldn't say house proud as such. This must be their kind of thing. It didn't matter.
Everything had to be in its place.
It was clean and tidy. Not like it mustn't be like that. You were afraid to turn round and knock
she
anything
didn't make
over.
A fuss.
It was clean and tidy. Yes. And that was nice things, of course. In those days I was earning, by this day of time I was earning, she liked nice clothes, but finances as such weren't able to give her all she did. When I went away on these jobs, I used to get the subsistence allowance, and that all went into the kitty to help the thing on. No, but she liked nice clothes, but... She was house proud too, not to exaggeration. Clean, tidy.
She had someone to help her once a week.
Once a week for quite a number in the early day, in the early stages, yes. And then Hilda, I think that's what her name was, called character. Something happened about her, and then carried on her own. Then.
Did you entertain a lot? Did you have lots of visitors?
No, not as such. No, just only neighbours. No. Wouldn't say no.
But Jessie came to stay.
Jessie was staying from time to time while she was in between these trips on the Orient Line. It was about 13 weeks, I think it was, the round trip. And then they have about a month at home. And then quite often Jessie would come home and within a couple of hours she'd be in bed and she'd stop there for several days, kind of thing. And she and Annie used to discuss everything under the sun. To be quite honest, it got quite bad above my head.
Did she do any? She didn't do any gardening. She wasn't keen on.
No. She just pottered around the garden. But this time I was flitting about so much that, looking at it from my standards of today, it was a disgrace. But I was leaving home at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting home at 7:30 at night, and then Saturdays not until 3 o'clock. Though there was not much incentive to take an interest in garden, I was too tired.
Did she sort of make a companion of Warwick? I mean, did...
Oh, yes. They were closer than that. Oh, yes. A deep... And they're still, if Anna was alive now, she thought the world of Annie and Warwick thought the world of her.
So did they go out for walks together?
Oh, yes, many times. They would go for miles, wander around, yes. Oh, you... when she was fit and well, yes.
And did they read books together and
study
they
discussed
together?
But all the whole time her teaching, her education of Warwick was all on the higher level. I'll be quite honest, it was above my standard.
Did he become a Rosicrucian?
No.
See.
No, he was so interested and tied up in his engineering world, that one might say his first and last thought was on his business, but deep down, the curate I spoke of, well, Mr. Killick, E.T. Killick, he thought the world of Warwick. And he said the potential was there. So much so that he would have done anything to have got him into the church. So that,
and he went to the church a bit, did she? I mean,
Yes, she was deeply. She would go to church with him. As I say, she used to take him round to all the various churches and discuss the pros and cons of the various religions, leaving him eventually to make his own choice. Which is, well, a wonderful education, training, as I speak of it as, from the Kenny family, all bore fruit.
Did she, I mean, did she, what did she enjoy doing, you know, to enjoy herself? I mean, did she go to cinema?
Entertaining people in a homely way and reading, but she didn't do so much reading towards the latter years because probably the diabetes might have been affecting her eyes or wouldn't know, didn't know. But she was quite happy in her homely family, but she enjoyed meeting what I might call educated people, if it's the right word, and discussing problems with them on a higher train of thought.
Did she ever talk about suffragette days very
much? No, did she? No.
She wasn't absorbed in that.
She virtually forgot it.
Did she?
Other than, I know there was, there had been a split in the movement when Pethick Lawrence's left the movement.
That's right, yes.
Because Mrs. Pethick Lawrence and Lord Pethick Lawrence, they were, Annie was invited down to,
Well, the Mascot, probably.
The Mascot, yes. And she was invited down there, and they again would have liked to have adopted Annie had her as a daughter. And she used to thoroughly enjoy those outings. But after that, didn't occur after the marriage so much.
So she didn't go and visit the Pethick Lawrences very much?
No, didn't renew. She kept in Jessie, of course, and then Grace went off to America. And she was lecturing on, she was really high.
She was a social worker.
Yes, a social worker. And she was exceedingly learned, if that's again the right word, and a theosopher in the Theosophical Society.
That's right. Yeah.
And she was lecturing all over. Yeah. That was Grace's clock. I mean, that was given to her after she came back from America, and it's quite an interesting one. She's given it to me now. I repaired it. I went down to see Grace, and Esther had told me that it was not going. However, I said, all right, well, I'll repair it. I've got it going. I told Grace it was ready for her. She said, well, I can't stand the noise, Jim, now. Let you have it.
That's so splendid.
I treasure that, because it's an early Seth Thomas. In the middle 1800s, probably late 1800s.
Isn't it?
So I feel I've still got a touch with the movement. It's a nice movement.
Was she fond of music?
Yes.
Because you said that's what originally attracted her.
Yes. Deeply fond of music. We had little gramophone sessions that. She was. And deeply fond of music from, if I might say, the ethereal side of it, I think.
Classical music, was it?
Or yes, yes.
Singing
I can always see it now, when Warwick was home from school, we'd sit round the fire, the three of us, and Warwick used to get Annie on to singing some of the old Lancashire songs, and he used to split his sides laughing, but she thoroughly enjoyed it, almost a child, just the Lancashire dialect songs, and as her, and his brother, Ridge. He and Wilfrid Pickles were two of the authorities on the Lancashire dialect. Now Warwick can tell you, he wouldn't mind me to tell you that he and his uncle, Bridge, they raised merry hell with the BBC over a programme that was put out, it must have been in 1951, I was at Egham. With Annie as a centrepiece, in which she was depicted as a cotton worker in clogs and shawl, and the whole thing was written around her. Warwick was livid, using a raw Lancashire dialect, of which he hadn't got a fingernail in her speech.
She'd been educated out of it.
Out of it, yes.
Mm. Did she ever go back to Lancashire? Did she like Lancashire? I mean, did she
pine for it? No, she didn't go back. Oh, well, she went... No, I don't think... As such, no. She didn't go back to Lancashire, but I know one of her schoolgirls, Alice Hurst. Oh, I met her several times. She was a... They must have been... These two were a pair of girls at school. And many things that Alice Hurst told me about Annie, but the things they did, that pair of them, were extraordinary. We decided that after the cremation, and if I might use the term, Uncle Tom probably and all were at Golders Green, it came back to Warwick's house. They'd married there and they were living in Solishot in Letchworth. And I had an idea, but I thought it would be nice, and I thought Annie might appreciate it, if we broadcast her ashes over all the ground that she used to worship through the Chew Valley, where they used to wander for hours and hours and miles and miles. So we must have got into the papers somehow. The papers in all the papers at that time, but the Danny had passed over and cremation, I think that's all her activities. And that we were contemplating going to Lancashire. And Alice got to hear of this somehow, I forget now, but we got to the end of the valley, we knew there was a little public house as such, we didn't know if it was a hotel, but well, she said, we can have a meal here if we can get one. So we went into this public house and at the end of the valley and came out. I said, there's somebody here that you know, I think. Who is this? And this little old lady, that's so high, came down, Alice Hurst. And we took her up the valley and told her what we were going to do. And then we took her back into Oldham and gave her a meal and kept in touch with her until she died. But Annie used to keep in touch occasionally with those people.
Did she? Yes.
And she always had this love of Lancashire and the hills, particularly at the back of her mind the whole time.
Did she? But you didn't visit Lancashire much or anything like that?
And we eventually then, we took Annie's ashes up to Chew Valley and broadcast them. I've got some photographs in there of distributing them.
Mm.
And
but she still sang these songs, did she?
Oh, yes, these Lancashire, or what one might call the Lancashire songs and songs of her mother. And she thoroughly entered into the spirit of them. Nothing was too low or nothing was too high. This is an extraordinary character.
I'd love to have heard her doing her piece.
Only quiet. And then parties with the Christmas parties we had. She'd be the life and soul of the party.
Did she play bridge or play games?
No. She loved to play games with Warwick, yes. And even parlour games. Sure, she'd hardly enter into the spirit of it as such.
Yeah, she sounds great.
Nothing. she had, and we've never found out, but I think I have. We used to have a thing that used to beat us all. You could give her a series of figures. And who was it? There were two lines of figures. One line of figures, and she'd put a complimentary line and give us the answer of these figures. Now, she never told us how she used to do this, and I think since the computerisation business, we were making so many comparisons, she must have had a computerised brain.
Yeah.
But outstanding things of this kind.
Did she listen to the radio much?
The plays, yes. Music, yes. But I wouldn't say she wasn't a slave to it.
No.
And I don't think she would have been a slave to this thing either.
No.
Because it prevented her thinking.
Hmm. Did she have a study of her own with books in it?
Oh yes, well, it had very few books as such, but we used to use the parlour, as we called it, the sitting room, and then eventually she had the bedroom, she had a lot of books, but not, she'd given a lot of them gone after we got married, or before we got married, I think. Because she had no settled home, they were moving about like kangaroos.
So she didn't go away into a room of her own to read?
She'd come sit by the side of the fire. And I was away so much, of course, that she had. And when Warwick was away, she had so much time that was filled in, I'm sure, with the reading and the letters she wrote.
She wrote a lot of letters, did she?
I've got some of them now that I treasure.
Mm.
They're just out of this world. Her power of expression and the words that are completely beyond me. I couldn't. I tell you, I'm much better with a hammer and chisel.
Did she ever see anything of the Pankhurst?
Pardon?
Did she ever see anything of the Pankhurst?
Yes. Okay. In touch with Christabel, but there was quite a lot of controversy had arisen. She didn't keep in touch with Sylvia so much,
but they wrote to each other a bit.
Yes, yes. They wrote to Christabel. Or letters, or pages and pages and pages. For Christabel thought the world, it was mutual between them. They idolised each other. He was such an outstanding, they were too outstanding. I met Christabel twice or three times. I think she gave a series of Campus Road. But she'd only got to walk, she'd only got to open the door. And it was like a beacon. The personality was oozing out of her.
Did she come to visit you then quite a lot?
No, I wouldn't tell her. No, about three times, I think. Then she went off to America.
I see, and then you didn't see her.
No, because she died out there.
Yes.
And she wrote her book.
Unshackled?
Yes, Unshackled. I've got a copy of that. And that, you see, was not Grace, I expect, has told you all of the history of that.
Yes.
He wrote it, and it was not to be published until after she passed.
That's
Grace
right.
found it when she was going through with a
papers. What about Mrs. Pankhurst? Did you see anything of her?
I met her once, I think, no.
Did you?
And that was all, I think, only once.
So they weren't in close contact?
Oh, no.
At all.
They may have, in writing, yes, but as far as the after the marriage, no. Well, with Christabel, they kept in all touch for a long time.
And Grace, of course. I
and heard. Grace, yes.
Did you see a lot of... I suppose Grace was in America, of course, wasn't she? So
yes, at that period, yes. But until she went to America, well, Grace was virtually on the doorstep, because everything, Annie had only got to lift a little finger, and Grace would often get it done.
Did she really? They were very, very close friends, weren't they?
Yes.
Because they lived together a bit, didn't they, until you married, in fact.
Yes, they lived for quite a while. And then, it was during that period, they were lived in Mecklenburg Square. That's where we came back to. That was the one they lived in. Tom Robertson, who was a Scotsman, very fine artist, he gave us a painting of Lochranza. When we were married, Tom Robertson gave us a painting of Lochranza. Got to do that. And yet, Joan, sorry to say, she hasn't got much time for it.
Well, perhaps it's changed since you went there.
Lochranza Square for a while after coming back.
What about the Second World War? What did you both do in the Second World War?
Well, I was quite deeply involved in the centre, the training centre in those days, and then I became. Deeply involved in the home guard, the fire guard. I became lecturer fire guard officer. I was sent away by the Ministry of Works, I think it was, yes, Ministry of Works, to a course at Easing Mould, and I came back with what they told me was an honours certificate. I seemed to fall on my feet, and so I became deeply involved in the organising of the fire guard system, because we're being, as they wanted to classify us as civil servants, our first and last thought was my activity was for the benefit of the department. I got a dispensation or something. I was allowed to use the training for lecture.
You were too old, I suppose, to go to actually to the front.
Well, they wouldn't have released us, because from the many, we had many people that were quite fit and capable, and they claimed that we were doing a much more useful job in training and ordinary services.
What was Annie's attitude to the war, actually? I mean,
she was. She was pacifist to a degree that she didn't want anybody hurt. But when it came to the gloves are thrown down, she was heart and soul in it.
Yes, I see.
And whether she urged Warwick on or not, I know, and I always, whether I did the right thing or not, I don't know. For some reason, to this day, I can't understand. I don't mind telling you this because nobody else knows it. I don't know why I did it. I came home one evening and there's paper on the grand piano, and there was Warwick. He said, oh, will you sign this? I said, what's this for? He said, application to join the Navy. And I said, no. Now, why I said that, I don't know to this day. But soon after that, when I was sent off to North Centre at Stafford, I got a letter to say that he joined Fleet Air on. So I can only wish him the very best of luck. Why I said that, I mentioned it once or twice to him, he said, don't worry. Because had I gone into the Fleet Air on at that stage, it's quite probable I should have been in that first raid on the Bismarck, I think it was,
yeah,
with the Swordfish, and I should have been, I shouldn't have been here.
Was Annie worried when he went off the war?
Yes, I think so. We went and saw him off, but she never showed it. Mm. She had this power of holding it back.
Mm.
She was deep, and she must have written him. She, I'm almost sure, I know she used to write him long, long letters, and if they were, they must have been on the same level as those she wrote to me. It was just, I don't know why I did deserve it.
Mm.
Mm. I don't mind admitting it.
But did she, was she active in war work, like sort of WVS or anything like that?
No.
Mm. She was just really running the house.
Yes,
and
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, she was not that type to bustle about and get into an activity of that kind. No, her whole life was centred around looking after me and work.
Mm. So really, the general picture you're painting is she became very domesticated,
Yes.
Mm.
And of course, when Warwick was married, again, was deep down, that was her first and last thought. Their welfare.
Mm.
He's done exceptionally well.
So you think she would have been pleased at the outcome?
Oh, she'd been, I'm sure of it, Well, she was, up to the day he died, she died. And what I so admire, I had some strings to pull, but I never did.
Mm.
He's got to where he is as a recognised authority, and Joan will tell you this, that he is respected in the highest circles in the crane world.
Mm. Mm.
So that he's done this entirely off his own bat.
Mm. Mm. That's very, very interesting, and that gives me a really very full picture. What did she actually look like? I mean, did she age a lot?
Oh yes. Well, I would say that was Annie.
That's when she was in the movement.
When I first met her.
Yes.
No, after the movement.
After the movement. That was very beautiful.
Warwick was what? I don't think it was 12 months when when the book was completed.
Mm.
The publishers wanted a photograph, so we were sent off to Hearts or Hunts in Baker Street, and that was taken.
Mm.
And it was one taken of Warwick and I.
Mm.
And I don't know where that is, that photograph, but this is more typical.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very.
Now, she put on that weight after we were married. Well, no, not after. It was, there were signs of it before we were married. I've got photographs in there somewhere. But
this is you in here.
No. That was I took it. I took that one actually. Those were some.
Is that you? Oh, I see.
That was my ex-trainee.
I see.
Yeah. He and his
and that's
wife.
Warwick, is it?
No. Warwick was at school during this period. These were neighbours of ours, Annie and that, Mrs. Hart. They were wonderful friends. Wonderful friends. They used to have some great fun.
That's a nice photograph.
We used to have little evenings between that and Mrs. Hart.
Yes.
With their son, and we used to have a game, the war game, and Mrs. Hart and Mr. Hart and Kenneth, they had their schemes for this war game, their plans, and they used to keep them between to themselves, and then encourage Annie and Mrs. Hart. They'd have their games, and Kenneth would write out a scheme for his mother, and I'd buy that one in between. And they were, they've been fits of laughter over these antics they got up to. But she thoroughly enjoyed those.
She seemed to have enjoyed life in general.
Those musical evenings, yes. Mm. Yes.
I mean, she seems to have. She had a strong sense of humour, didn't she?
Yes.
And
beside all this other wonderful depth of thought that she could turn on as a tap kind of thing. On the other hand, there was this wonderful sense of humour, and it doesn't matter how lowly a person was, she'd go down to them. Even the gypsies coming to the door, they thought the world of Annie. It was an extraordinary kind of magnetism that...
Why did they think the world of her, do you think?
Well, it was her approach to them. There was some telepathic kind of sound. If they were Irish particularly, this telepathic feeling that went out straight away, and there's a sympathy.
She had no side to her or barriers with people.
No. It didn't matter if it was Tom, Dick or Harry or the King or Queen. She'd meet them with equal... an equal plane.
And very open in her personality.
Yes,
that's interesting. So, anyway, she was fond of clothes, but she didn't sort of make a great thing of them at all. That's really given me a marvellous picture. I think you answered just about every question I wanted to ask you. Just have a look. Oh, you say you saw a bit of Flora Drummond just now and again.
Not enough to form any deep opinion, except that she was one bustuous kind of person, all bubbling over with energy. And typical of being called the general.
She was a small, dumpy sort of woman, wasn't she?
There is a very good photograph, I understand, of her, and also one of Annie, a friend of mine, an old associate in the training centre, he might be up this afternoon. He came across them. He usually goes back to his native heath in Glasgow and wandered around the museum. He phoned me. He said, "I've just had a big pleasant surprise." "Oh, what, mate?" He said, "I've just seen a photograph of your wife and Flora Drummond in the museum in Glasgow."
Oh, wow.
In a special room.
There's...
Other than that, I don't have any... anything else that's in the suffrage movement in Scotland.
Did she actually keep her letters and her relics and her badges and things
Not
like
me,
that?
Some of her badges. I came I got one WSPU badge, which we had when she was cremated. We had it put into the book at the Golders Green, and they put the little painting of the badge. No, she didn't keep any of the... kept a lot of correspondence, and I think those were all destroyed.
That's a pity, because any letters that she wrote or were written to her would be very valuable, you know.
So we had things were all upside down at Campus Road in some ways, but no, there's nothing was kept. Now, what happened to them? Well, I was in hospital when Campus Road was broken up, as I call it. Warwick and Joan did it with the very best of intentions, and they always told me that I'm a bit of a magpie, that I say far too many things, and I have said to them when they got on this line of thought, that, you know, if everybody were like you, we shouldn't have any museums, because those these prints I've got there, that one on the top right hand corner, some of those were sold recently in Sotheby's for quite a considerable amount of money over.
It makes it homely though. I mean, it looks nice and warm and comfortable in here, you know, with all these things.
Yes. My own work. Shopping, cooking, washing.
Well, you're very comfortable here, I must say.
Oh,
I like
well,
this.
My little back garden. Was
your garden's beautiful.
Waist high in weeds when I came here.
Yes, it's beautifully kept.
Yes, we dug out a whole lot of lumps of concrete. I thought, what can we do with that? We'll make a rockery. Mm. So what kind of a rockery without a pool? So on,
it's very attractive, actually. Beautifully done. Sorry, can you get by?
Yes, think of the bedroom, but it's like a big store. I've shoved everything
in there. Oh, yes, it's very nice, isn't it? It's big enough for you to manage, isn't it? It's not
too big. I designed it so that with a minimum of work I can cut the grass and trim it up in about half an hour. I've got a head of plants all around here. They take a minimum of work.
Yes, that's splendid.